this is Justice Radio, a weekly show on WMPG with your host, Linda Small. I'm the executive director of Reentry Sisters, an organization that specializes in helping women and girls return home from prison. And you can learn more on our website at reentrysisters.org. And today we're speaking with Dani Shiflett, the center director for the Maine Recovery Action Project, about recovery, reentry, and their event Beyond the Sentence, a night of advocacy and action. Welcome, Dani.
Hi, how are you doing, Linda?
Great, doing great today. Thanks so much for joining us. And to start us off, could you introduce yourself and share what brought you to this work?
Certainly. So my name is Dani Shiflett, and as she said, I am the director of the Access Center for MERAP, and I'm a person in long-term recovery. I'm also a justice-impacted individual. What brought me to this work is my involvement in the criminal legal system. Following two of my incarcerations, one, I was released with, you know, nothing but 2 feet and a heartbeat, is what I like to say. And during that incarceration, I had planned to, you know, do all these great things when I was released, but unfortunately I made it 2 hours out the door before I had relapsed. So that is one reason. The other one was because I actually gave birth to my youngest daughter while in state's custody. A corrections officer cut her umbilical cord, and being released with not a bottle, a onesie, a diaper in sight, that definitely impacted me and inspired me to, you know, join this fight to help folks bridge the gap between reentry and integrating into the community.
Thank you so much for sharing that. I think, you know, for women in general, that's a pretty typical story. You know, I spent 13 years inside, and even after all that time, you know, your social capital is near zero. And there just aren't a lot of resources, particularly that focus on the needs, specific needs of women, mothers. Generally, they leave, they're heads of household, and it can be a real struggle. So thank you for sharing that with us. So can you tell us a little bit about what does Maine Recovery Action Project do? What is their mission?
Our mission is we're a grassroots organization that is rooted in harm reduction principles. For me, at the Access Center, we act as a drop-in center for our community. We serve marginalized individuals as well as businesses and the community at large. We want to be good neighbors. We offer the harm reduction and SSP services to individuals in need.
Yeah, that's great. I think that you're talking about, you know, a peer-led recovery support, right? That type of model. Can you talk a little bit about what that actually means? And why is that better than, say, more traditional models if it's a peer-led recovery?
So peer-led means that all of us involved have lived experience, whether it's ourselves or as an affected other, a justice-impacted individual. And there's power in that, right? Because we have been, you know, where you have been or they have been. And I feel like it's much easier for us to meet people where they're at. And that is the basis of the peer-led model, you know. Folks, save lives is what I like to say, you know.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, that's great. And I think that also is about trust as well, right? Because people who have been through the carceral system and other systems that we interact with, whether that's family, policing, healthcare, all of those systems, it's really hard to build trust again once you've been through these types of systems. And I think peer-led helps soften that a little bit, right? Drops those barriers so that you're talking to someone who gets it, right?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. There's something to speak of somebody who can say, like, I have been where you have been. I hear you. I see you. For me, you know, being a justice impacted individual and having folks say that to me that had lived experience and didn't, it was much easier to trust in the one that I knew had felt what I had felt before.
Right. Yeah. You're talking about really how important community is, right, to reentry and recovery, which is one of the founding principles of Reentry Sisters. I mean, we have each other, and that's what makes a difference, particularly when you leave and you have no social capital. Well, you have us, right? We have each other. And that can really make the difference of whether you achieve your goals or don't, whatever they are, right? I think that's the other part, is it's non-judgmental, you know, mm-hmm. It's in service to not only ourselves, but each other. And it makes such a huge difference.
As the individual that, you know, is re-entering, it's like, all we want is a chance, you know, just a chance. And it's very few and far between. I felt like somebody was giving me a chance that wasn't one of us, that wasn't each other.
Yeah, that's such an important point. And so, for people who are sort of on the outside looking in, what are some of the barriers that they may not realize exist for folks who are in recovery and reentry?
So first and foremost, and this is always like one of the biggest ones, right? Because you need it to almost do everything in life. Lack of identification and documents, you know, birth certificate, social, the ID, housing restrictions, you know, especially people who have certain convictions, employment discrimination, gaps in transportation. I think that's becoming one of the more better known barriers. Still, we have the message has to go so much further because we haven't made a lot of headway on, you know, correcting or bridging that gap. Child support, financial penalties. Overlapping supervision requirements. That was huge for me. That was something that led to, you know, one of the times that I recidivized. Those are probably the key barriers that people, you know, just don't think of. One time I had a House delegate say to me, "Well, how difficult is it to get birth certificate? I just got two for my kids last week." And I was thinking in my head, the place where I was at, they call the like City Hall vital statistics. I didn't even know what vital statistics meant. So it's very difficult to get your birth certificate, sir.
Yeah, I think there's a complete disconnect in the level of barriers because many people, you know, you're dealing with folks who you need to speak in plain English. Things need to be not so complex. And to expect people to come out who are already facing, and I'll ask you about stigma here in a little bit, but who are already facing tremendous oppression from the system they've been in. Background checks are ubiquitous, which makes finding a job and getting housing extremely difficult. And if you don't have a roof over your head and you don't have stable income, the idea of you trying to figure out how to get these vital documents where somebody can just write, get online because you have a computer, maybe you don't have a computer, right? And you wouldn't even know where to start, where to get those particular documents. So, can you talk a little bit about, first of all, the stigma that people face in this particular situation and a little bit more about supervision requirements and how those create more hurdles than help for people.
So the stigma is kind of like a blink, like you just said, the trying to get a job. But for me, I'm a two-time convicted felon. You know, checking that box, the stigma that comes with that, I feel like it automatically counts folks out. I might be more qualified than another, but because I check that box, my application is going to the bottom of the pile. In the community, people have fear and label us with things like criminal, dangerous, violent. It's automatically assumed that, you know, maybe I'm not a good mom. I don't have money. The stigma is what kills people. You know, stigma sends people back out. It's what keeps us from asking for help. So, you know, seeking services, that fear, I would say that stigma is probably one of the biggest barriers to getting services because folks are just afraid to ask for service.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point about the ability to ask for help. It sounds really easy, but there's a lot of fear attached to past trauma, right? The trauma that drove you into the system in the first place. And if you don't have opportunities to heal that trauma, you're carrying that with you on top of everything else that you're trying to resolve in your life.
With trauma, this might be a little off topic, but I always like to, you know, bring this to light is that so if you're involved in the criminal legal system, there's a good chance that you have like a complicated life. So we're going to take folks who already have a complicated life and further complicate their life, incarcerate them, more than likely destabilize them, whether it's, you know, they lose their job, their children, you know, their housing. They might be on mental health medications, which get off kilter, or they may be in some type of program for substance use disorder, which, you know, gets off kilter. And then, you know, they get released. We have no services, you know, at the door, so to speak. The stigma is real. People don't ask for help. And then we wonder as a community or society why folks are recidivizing and at such an astronomical rate. You know, it's that right there. And that's why I think reentry is so important. It's like one of the most crucial points I feel like to encounter somebody who is maybe in this cycle. That's a real chance for, you know, do I go left or do I go right in the Y on the road? Am I going to stay on track? Am I going to recidivize? And, you know, us as service providers or lawmakers, community members, it's our duty to meet those folks at the door and, you know, figure out what their goals or barriers and get them to where they're going.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. I think that that is such a key point that we need to get to those root causes, and that when you talk about people leaving without services, that is so real. Like today, if you're in the prison, they'll give you 2 weeks of your medication, which might not be the medication you were prescribed in the beginning anyway. And so you walk out the door, you have good intentions for yourself. Anybody who's listening knows that you just can't walk out and get a doctor's appointment in 2 weeks. It is impossible. It took me 10 months to even find a new primary care physician because everybody was either booked up or not accepting new clients and all of those types of things. And I had, some resources and some help behind me. And so, we have a lot of people who are making, especially women, who are making these horrible choices. Do I go back to this environment that I know drove me into the system in the first place, right? Either this particular relationship or my nuclear family or my circle of friends. And so we're asking women in particular to cut ties with all of these people that they know. And it might not have been the best relationships, but they were their people. And to go now go it alone with no help and no services. Yeah. Do you see that?
Oh,
Your
absolutely.
work.
I've lived it. I see it. It's happening every day to hundreds of people. To bring back to the point about, the supervision on top of what you're just saying. So we get out with nothing, no services. We've separated ourselves from that old circle and crowd and have no support. Probably a lot of us don't have family. And then we have all these requirements, right? Show up at 7 a.m., do 25 hours of community service, go to 5 meetings a week, get a job, just on top of requirements. And it's like, they don't consider, does this person have transportation? Do they have money? Do they have childcare? How far away do they live? Does this person even have a phone to communicate or a mailbox to receive a notice that says they have to show up? There's so many things. And then the supervision, the caveat to me is that, then they take folks and they might reincarcerate them or sanction them because they missed an appointment. Do you get arrested if you don't show up at your doctor's appointment? And what you were just saying before is like, I heard trauma on trauma on trauma, where, the trauma of getting incarcerated, the trauma of the incarceration, the trauma of the release, the trauma of not having anybody and any services. And then we get, sanctioned, we reoffend and are getting, incarcerated again, starting that cycle all over for something that's not even arrestable offense sometimes.
Right. Thank you so much for pointing that out because I don't think people understand. You could just be living your normal day-to-day life that has consequences that are far above and beyond whatever it is that you were not able to do. And you weren't given the tools to even fulfill those requirements. And like you said, this is not out of the realm of possibility. I couldn't make it to this meeting or I couldn't make it to this appointment. And that's going to reincarcerate me. Or I don't have a job yet. I have fees and fines that I couldn't pay because I'm trying to feed myself or my children. And that gets you reincarcerated. And it sort of perpetuates, right, this cycle of interruption in someone's life who's actually trying, right? They're actually trying to do better.
I just want to piggyback off of you said fees and fines. Let's talk about a barrier. Fees and fines. You were just incarcerated for however long. You don't have employment. You probably need a new undergarments and hygiene products. Probably don't have anywhere to stay, or you might, which is going to cost money. But all the life necessities, let's say, you have to, be able to provide those for yourself, right? Now you have to pay these fines and fees, or like you said, you get reincarcerated potentially. How do you pay these fines and fees if you don't have an ID, you can't get a job, you don't have transportation? Like all of the things that we're talking about, it's just another thing that is a barrier and sets us up for failure. The system is not designed to, encourage or guide us or, help us make things, easy. Every single thing I feel like is stacked against us.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Audience, you are listening to Justice Radio with your host, Linda Swong, and today we're speaking with Danny Shiflett about recovery and reentry. So, Danny, this is, sort of a very sad situation that we're talking about here. It almost feels like setting people up for failure and perpetuating trauma and oppression. So, what changes would you like to see? What approaches should we be taking a look at for people in recovery and those who are leaving the carceral system or trying to leave the carceral system?
So I think that you hit the nail on the head is like we need to shift the perspective from like why don't they just, meaning like the individual to like how do we fix this system, right? And I think that a lot of things that we could work on is the Clean Slate Initiative, housing access, occupational licensing reform, treatment access, transportation funding. I think that those could be the start to bridging the gap. We don't have a people problem, we have a coordination and policy problem. The folks that are doing the work on the ground need to get better coordinated. And then the folks who are up top at the state need to take a look at some of these policies that we have and either tweak them, change them, implement new ones. We need employers to start hiring second chance candidates, potentially a review of background checks. I think that that could go a long way in terms of helping bridge the gap and people, seeking employment. I think that that is a good foundation, a good place to start.
Thank you for that. That's some really excellent examples. I want to talk about a few of those in a little bit more detail. So, for our listeners, could you give an overview of what you mean by Clean Slate Initiative?
Sure. So that's LD 1911, I think. And that would seal certain criminal offenses after a certain period of time without legal involvement. So, like currently, folks who want to have things sealed or expunged, I think is the term, from their record, often requires like hiring a lawyer and, doing a ton of paperwork and tracking things down, submitting it to a judge, and then they have the say, I believe. This system, and correct me if I'm wrong, Linda, I think that you have some experience and knowledge with Clean Slate. It would kind of be like a system where maybe folks are entered and if they, don't have a criminal charge of whatever the certain offenses are within a set period of time, it would just fall off their record. Does that sound?
It does. And I think it really is getting to what the second chances mean. And so if we believe in second chances here, and someone has paid their debt to society, and yet, right, every sentence here in the state is a life sentence right now. And so, right, so this gives them the opportunity. Listen, I've been on the right path for a decade. And this stuff is still hanging over my head every time I look for a job or a place to live or get a loan, or go to school or any self-improvement. And we're not holding this against law enforcement. Law enforcement can still have this information, but your everyday person doesn't need that information if you're out in the community doing what you're supposed to be doing.
So, Linda, you listed a lot of things that the Clean Slate could circumvent and help with, but let's try this on. I have not been doing well for a decade. On March 11th, I will celebrate 5 years from incarceration and in long-term recovery. And guess
Congratulations.
what?
That's a long time.
I cannot go on a field trip with my children.
Right.
On top of all the things that you said, that is what the clean slate means to me, is being able to, be a mom, fully. It's tough. It's very tough. And slate would, give me that opportunity. It would allow me to, go on field trips with my children.
Yeah, I love that, Danny. And thank you for bringing that up. I was just talking to a woman. She's in one of our Reentry Sisters education programs and was saying the same thing, that she cannot do the same thing. She cannot go with a group of kids and be one of the chaperones at an event, which is incredibly not only embarrassing, sad if we really care about families. Because what we're doing right now, the rate of women's incarceration in Maine is going up and men has been going down for the past 4 years, right? So something is drastically wrong. We are also locking up women in the 55 to 64 range at a rate of 86% higher. Okay, so we don't mind locking up our grandmothers, our older aunties, right? There's something very wrong with what we are doing right now. And as we know, the mom, the matriarch of the family, is the glue, right? And if you pull her out of that family unit, the kids suffer, the school systems suffer, the communities suffer. And what we're doing is trying to solve social issues with incarceration. And we know this doesn't work, right? We're just making it worse. And so I love the fact that you brought up moms, because about 72% of women incarcerated in Maine are mothers, and we're destroying families.
We are dismantling families. The system is stealing souls, in my opinion. It is the most horrific thing that I've ever seen. And you said that, using punitive measures. You and I know, and a lot of the folks that, are in our, circle advocating for these changes know that it's a public health issue. Not to mention, it's, it could turn into like a public safety. The stable housing and employment would reduce recidivism. Keeping moms on site. When reentry fails, it's the community that absorbs the cost, right? Like emergency rooms, shelters, foster care, all the things that dismantle a family. And then it falls on the community to pick up the pieces.
Yeah, I thank you for saying that, because I think when you were talking about lawmakers and policy and legislation, I think that they're missing the boat on mass incarceration impacts everyone, not just the people who are incarcerated and not just their loved ones. It is everybody's problem when you talk about this being a public health issue, because in fact it is. And it also ends up perpetuating generational trauma, generational incarceration. And we're not just talking about the moms and dads who are incarcerated now, we're talking about putting the lives of their children in jeopardy. So communities are made up of people. The legislation is made up of people. What can your average citizen do, right? If they want to get involved and help, what are some of the things that they can do?
For the community, the call to action would be like volunteer, whether that's at a food pantry, driving folks to and from treatment or appointments in our youth system. They can advocate for reentry, friendly policies. A lot of times, like you said, the stigma, right? Let's talk about back to the stigma is like folks with lived experience. I feel like our truth is what, touches hearts and changes minds. But lawmakers, policymakers, they want the community buy. So, as somebody in the community, if you believe in second chances, I know that every single person has a mother, brother, sister, neighbor, friend, something that has been touched by, the system in some way. Use your voice, step up and advocate for reentry, for the folks that are stigmatized against and sometimes aren't taken seriously. I think that is a good place for folks to help if, just community members.
Yep, I think that's a great idea, is everybody needs to raise their own voice, and the point that with 1 in 3 adult Americans impacted by the carceral system, that means you know somebody and they're either very close to you or they're in your circle. And also, since the barrier seems to be so low, because we punish mental health issues, we punish substance use issues, we punish people for things that really are public health issues. So you might think you're immune, but maybe not so much, because the barrier to get right entangled in the criminal legal system is not very high. That hurdle is not very high. And that's one way and one reason to step up, because you're protecting your community members and you're also protecting yourself and your own family by speaking up. And I would add one more thing that people could do is, wherever it is that you're working, go to your human resources department or person and say, hey, what is our policy on hiring justice impacted people? And why is it the way that it is? And at least question that.
It could go so much deeper than that, like, landlords being open to, renting to felons, or like you said, employers with a second chance. I think also we could even add in, like, I guess it wouldn't be the community, but folks that, really have a voice and can make an impact in terms of, like, turning the tide would be our folks like the probation officers, law enforcement, other folks in our community, business owners, service providers. Like, everybody, I always say everybody has a part. Right. There, everybody has a part, and it's everybody. It's our duty as just, good humans, to help our neighbors.
I love that idea of civic duty, because essentially what we're telling people who are in the position of at that intersection of recovery and reentry, we're asking them to be good citizens. We're not giving them the tools to be good citizens. And we are also, many of us, not leading by example either. And that's a very tough position to put people in. It's a very unforgiving position to put people in. And I think, we need to start leading with heart these days in our policies and practices. And, the other thing that I will just say is sometimes we do pass good legislation. Like there was a second chance bill, a piece of legislation passed, but implementation always seems to be a tough issue, because we're trying to change people's hearts and minds. And you can't do that with a bill or a policy. You know, that is also something that we need to work on by people stepping up and telling their stories and saying what they know is right and figuring out what is the next right thing to do. Yeah. So Danny, we just have a couple minutes left, and I just want to ask you one more thing. You know, is there, and just open-ended, is there anything that we haven't talked about that you want this message out there for our listeners?
Yeah, so this is like kind of more of like a technical on like the policy side. And this is something that I have seen restorative justice-wise in another state. And two things that would really help eliminate some barriers in those first couple of days out. So this comes down to like the ID, right? In this state, the individuals who are in the DOC, whether it's prison or jail, county, regional, they are released with a ID from the DOC, right? And then they are able to take that ID to the DMV. And whether it's, I think it's through some legislation and MOUs, they are able to get a ID card, a state ID card, free and with no extra documents. That DOC card is all encompassing for the required documents that everybody else needs to get that identification. The second thing that I've seen that I think would go a long way and be monumental is something that has affected me in my personal journey, and then helped me in my personal journey was my license was suspended because of non-payment of fines. You know, and how do you pay fines if you cannot work, drive, you know, all the things, right? So, if there was something that we could do there, whether it's entering into an agreement, an affidavit with the DMV, the courts, or, you know, wherever that might be, you know, I know the problems. I don't know the logistics or the semantics of the solution necessarily, but I know this is one. So, for the folks who, you know, have more experience than I, and, you know, if there's something we could do to, you know, eliminate that barrier, I think that would go a long way also. I just, you know, lastly want to say that folks, the stigma, the trauma, the assumptions, the people, you know, working that have the control and power over somebody's life when they're re-entering. I just want to share this little quick story. I was at a crisis interventionist training, and this woman, a presenter, put eight photos up on a projector and said, like, to the crowd, which one of these folks are in crisis? And there's like 300 people in the room. Everybody started yelling, number one, number eight, number seven, till the room went silent. Everybody's like staring at her, like, okay, lady, like, so who is it? And her response was like, what are you staring at me for? I have no idea. I Googled these photos. Meaning, like, you have no idea what an individual is going through unless you talk to them. Talk to them. So my call to action for everybody across the board is to talk to us. You know, treat us with love and compassion and dignity. You know, we are human. Our past don't define us. You know, we deserve that second chance.
Oh, I love that. I love that, Danny. Thank you so much for this insightful and meaningful conversation and for your work. And I think that's a great note to end on, that just love the person next to you or the person in front of you. Set your judgment aside and ask questions, because we all know at some point in our life, we could have gone left instead of right and been exactly where that other person is. And so thank you so much. And for our listeners, please visit Justice Radio show page on WMPG.org for archived episodes aired on WMPG, WERU, and WMHB. And a big thank you to our editor, Aaron Pyle, and to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series.